Well, hello. It's Sunday afternoon and time for the Money Hour. We will be talking about the economy, your investments, your savings, your plans for the future over the next hour. And this is Harry Brown. So I invite you to join me, stay with this show for the hour, and if you like, give me a call and ask a question, make a comment, criticism, send me a bill, do whatever you want. Just call 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. Or you can send me a question or a comment. The excuse me, the email address is question@harrybrown.org. question@harrybrown.org. Brown has an E on the end of it. Well, you know, last week I was talking about how the economy works and that the economy is self-adjusting and that speculative opportunities develop when the government intervenes because it creates an artificial situation temporarily. And the market, of course, is always working towards balance, always working towards what the economists call equilibrium, where supply and demand would be in harmony. But, of course, the government creates an artificial demand or an artificial shortage or an artificial surplus. But whatever it does, it throws supply and demand out of balance, and the market continues to work towards balance. And so it creates opportunities for a speculator to look at something that the government has done and say, well, this is going to be rectified by the market at some point. And so the speculator bets against the government, and sometimes he wins. Sometimes the speculator is right, but the timing is wrong, in the sense that the government is able to hold out, keep the market out of balance for perhaps many years. For example, I gave the incidence of gold, silver, and foreign currencies, how they have been price controlled for many years, so that when they were finally released from those controls in around 1970, they all zoomed way upward in price. But you could have, back in 1960, made a very strong case that gold would have to go up from $35, or that silver would have to go up, or that foreign currencies would have to go up. And you would have been right, but you would have been 10 years too early. So there is no guaranteed way that you can bet against the government and know that it's going to turn out all right. But when I was talking about this last week, I gave the example of people talking about energy policy and the government needing a national energy policy in order to make sure that we have everything we need. And of course, a national energy policy means maybe putting a tax on gasoline, a higher tax than we have already, so that people will use less oil. And then at the same time, the government subsidizes solar power or wind power, not nuclear power, because that's politically incorrect these days. But in one way or another, the government tries to make people use things that aren't really the right things to be using now, and the government tries to make people not use the things that are the most convenient and the most economical for people right now. If oil were so short in supply and so expensive, and solar power or wind power were so right for the economy, then the government wouldn't have to do anything. Because oil would be too expensive, solar power would be less expensive and more convenient, and people would just simply on their own buy solar power panels and set up solar power as the way to heat their homes and so on. And if hydrogen was the way to go for automobiles, the government wouldn't have to subsidize it. It would take care of itself because it would be the better alternative. And I'm really, to a certain extent, restating in other words what I said last week. But the reason I bring this up again is that during the week somebody called my attention to some articles that I had not seen. It appears that there are discoveries these days that I didn't know about. These discoveries indicate that oil is not a fossil fuel. As you may know, oil is supposedly generated from the remains of dinosaurs. Down in the earth, these dinosaurs have worked their way, dinosaur remains have worked their way down into the earth, and oil drillers go down and drill out what is the oil that comes from these dinosaurs. That's why they call it fossil fuel. But in fact, according to these discoveries, oil is not a fossil fuel. It does not come from dinosaurs. It does not come from any living thing. And it is, in effect, not a finite resource then. It is a sustainable resource. It is generated out of the earth itself, and there is more of it the deeper you go. The interesting thing is that the Soviet Union recognized the possibility of this, scientists in the Soviet Union, and they did a lot of work on it, but they were not able to bring it to fruition before the Soviet Union collapsed. But apparently, Russian scientists have continued with this so that this idea of drilling to super deep levels of the earth has continued there, and it has paid off, and now it appears that the Russians are the largest producers of oil in the world, larger than Saudi Arabia or Iraq, which were considered number one and number two. There's a lot more that has to come out on this to be really verified and for us to know for sure that oil is a what they call sustainable resource, meaning that we don't have to worry about the earth running out of oil. It's just a question of how deep we go. And if oil becomes more expensive, it will become more economical to dig deeply for oil. And as the process develops over time, it will become less expensive to dig for extremely deep levels for oil. So here, once again, the market is working its way out. And if we act upon what people say when they're crying wolf, when they're shouting out, oh, the world's running out of oil, we need to subsidize these other technologies and do this and that, then what we do is to fix in place things that are not the best for consumers, and we have these distortions in the market. There may be ways of taking care of it. Two articles on this oil situation have been posted on my Radio Links page. If you go to my website, harrybrown.org, right at the top of the page, you'll see a link to Radio Links, articles and websites mentioned on the radio shows. And you go actually to the Radio Links page for my political show, but right at the top it says click here for links to the investment show. And if you go there, there are two articles that you can read on this subject of oil being a sustainable resource rather than a finite resource. But I have other things in mind to talk about today. I just wanted to finish that off. And we also can talk about subjects that you have in mind if you want to call at 1-800-259-9231. Or email me, question@harrybrown.org. When we come back, I'm going to talk about the possibility of having a foreign bank account. Have you ever thought about that? Having some money outside the reach of your government? Boy, that's a pleasant thought. And it's not really as difficult as it may seem. So we'll talk about that. When we come back, this is Harry Brown. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and I promised that we would be talking during this segment about having a foreign bank account. That can seem very exotic, but it really isn't that exotic. It used to be a little bit more exotic when it was a different society than we have today. I first started getting involved with foreign banks back in the 60s and in the late 60s and then in the early 70s. And when I would talk to people about it, it seemed like a very, very, very arcane notion. I mean, the idea of sending money across the ocean and not being able to go in and see the people that you were dealing with and so on. But today, we do so much business on the internet or over the telephone and with people that you never see. If you have a brokerage account, it's probably not with somebody in the town where you live and you drop in and talk to the broker. You probably deal with a broker over the phone, and the broker may be 1,000 miles away from you. And you may deal with the broker over the internet through email and other ways. You may have found the broker on the internet. The same thing with mutual funds. You may be holding funds in various mutual funds, and of course you don't go into those offices and so on. So we are now used to doing business with people that we don't meet face to face. So what's the difference then with having money in an account that's in a foreign bank that may be on the other side of the ocean? Again, you're not going to meet the people face to face. I think that if you're planning for complete safety and you're trying to take into consideration all the possibilities of the future and perhaps setting up a permanent portfolio of the kind that I described a few weeks ago that would protect you whether we have prosperity, inflation, deflation, recession, whatever you're going to be taken care of, I think it's only prudent to have something that you own outside the reach of your own government. If you keep some assets in a different country from the one in which you live, you'll be less vulnerable to government activity. And perhaps even more important, you'll feel less vulnerable even if nothing ever happens that justifies your having a foreign bank account. You just simply won't have to worry so much about what your government might do next. And this applies no matter what country in which you live. It isn't just a question of what might happen in America. It's what might happen in Canada or France or Switzerland or England. Your portfolio will be safe enough to walk away from and forget about completely only if it allows for more than just the problems and the hazards that are obvious today. It really should allow for unforeseeable events that might occur a year from now, or 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. For example, if you keep some investments abroad, you have safe and easy protection against the surprises that might happen anywhere, such as confiscation of gold holdings by the government, or exchange controls, or civil disorder, or even war that touches America and destroys some facilities in America and destroys some records, perhaps records of your investments. Here are some of the benefits that I see in having some overseas holdings. Number one, you'd have the time and opportunity to respond to any extraordinary policies that your own government adopts. You know, no one knows how the people elected in the coming years might choose to solve the economic problems that the country will face. To many politicians, John Kerry, George Bush, or whoever, it might strike them that the quick and easy solution to some terrible national problem is to take away your property, as has happened so often in the past. Number two, your assets would be safe even if war or civil disorder or a weakening of law enforcement or a physical catastrophe should disrupt record keeping in your own country so that nobody knows whether you had an account in a mutual fund or some other place. Number three is you'll have some wealth of your own that is out of the reach of the litigation sharks in this country. The attorneys, the ambulance chasers who make their living by looking for people with what my friend calls clean wealth. And that is wealth that's right there ready to be plucked off. He contrasts that with dirty wealth, which is wealth that's hard to get at, hard for litigation to get, so that even if they won a case, it might take many years to get their hands on the wealth. My friend being Terry Coxon, who probably will be a guest on this show in coming weeks, and who specializes in keeping wealth out of the reach of government. A fourth possibility is that your entire estate will no longer be vulnerable to any kind of economic, political, or legal setback in your own country. Now, right now, some of these hazards that I've mentioned may seem very remote, and I think they are, in the sense that I have no reason to expect that they're going to touch you now. But they are real hazards, and now and then you feel that reality. When a politician urges something especially dangerous or foolish, or it's revealed that the tax collectors are acting in a particularly heavy-handed way, or when an international conflict threatens to erupt into something big that might touch facilities here in the United States. And someday one of these hazards may grow into an immediate threat. Geographic diversification, I think, is a necessary part of making your portfolio able to handle whatever hazard does materialize. And as I said, keeping some of your holdings overseas may at first seem to be the opposite of simplicity because it is so exotic. But opening and maintaining a foreign bank account really requires very little effort. It's, as I said, much like having an account with an American bank or brokerage firm that you never visit in person. Once you open the account by mail, it requires practically no monitoring. And then you can probably begin to develop a more relaxed attitude about the future. When some politician promises to fight the trade deficit or some other problem by building a wall around your country with foreign exchange controls, you won't get the feeling that you're trapped because you already have something on the other side of the wall. You'll know that you already have gold or some other asset sitting outside the reach of your own government. Now, you've probably heard a great deal over the years about Swiss bank secrecy and other things of that sort, and how the federal government has broken down all the walls of secrecy and now has access to banks in foreign countries. Well, a great deal of that is just mythology, and we'll talk about that when we come back from this break. This is Harry Brown. The phone number is 1-800-259-9231. I'll be glad to answer your questions or take your comments, so stay tuned. Well, welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and we're talking about foreign bank accounts as a possibility, a way of having something that you own outside the reach of your own government. Now, before we went to the break, I raised the question of whether foreign bank accounts can be actually secret from your government in the sense that they are out of the reach of the IRS and other government agencies that routinely just simply walk into American banks and ask for information and get whatever they want. There are, of course, several countries in the world that promote the idea that they have bank privacy rules and laws. The banks in the Caribbean created bank privacy rules and laws in those countries, in places like the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and so forth, after World War II. And they did it in order to attract foreign capital by saying, your money will be private here. You put your money in one of our banks, and we have laws that see to it that the U.S. government or any other government will never get that information. However, there is an important difference. These countries were just simply trying to attract foreign capital. But in countries like Switzerland or Austria, they have bank secrecy because the citizens of those countries want it. The people within the country want the privacy from their own government and from other prying eyes. I mean, it is very easy for even non-governmental agencies or institutions to get information from your bank here in the United States. But people in Switzerland and Austria didn't want that kind of transparency whereby anybody could get information, could get a credit report, could get all of this sort of thing, unless the individual himself voluntarily provided that information. And so Switzerland and Austria have been safer, and we have seen that in recent years as some of the countries in the Caribbean have folded as the U.S. government has moved in and said, we want information. Now, what about countries like Austria and Switzerland and Liechtenstein over there in Europe who prize themselves on having bank secrecy? Don't we read every once in a while an article in the Wall Street Journal or even in your daily newspaper that says that new arrangements have been made between the U.S. government and foreign governments like Switzerland or Austria to be able to get information? Well, what it comes down to is that if you're a world-class drug dealer or you're tied up in some billion-dollar controversy with your own government, it's possible, that a foreign bank might be brought under considerable pressure to reveal information about your account. But if you're a typical middle-class individual, your foreign holdings are going to be as anonymous as a fish in the Atlantic Ocean. The point is that there are these few high-profile cases that have been used to scare people into the idea that you can't do anything about getting a private account in a foreign bank because your government will follow you to the ends of the earth. Well, it can't follow you into some countries. All right, there are other things to discuss with regard to this, and we will as we proceed. But meanwhile, let's take a phone call from Dave in Arizona. Good afternoon, Dave.
Yes, Mr. Brown, how are you?
Just fine. What's happening?
Well, you know, I was just interested in your commentary there about foreign investing, and I just recently calculated my own net worth to be in the area of maybe as much as $900. So, you know, I'm looking into thinking some of it into Switzerland, maybe, just being facetious, of course.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I hope for your sake you're being facetious.
Yes, of course. I got a book this week that I ordered last week. It's called How You Can Profit from the Coming Devaluation.
Oh, my God.
And, yes, written by a very brilliant guy that I admire very much. And I was just wondering if you could maybe discuss some of the factors that led you to come to the conclusion that we were about to have a devaluation and compare those factors with where we stand right now, if you think any of the factors are in existence today.
Well, Dave is referring to a book that I published in 1970. In fact, it was my first book, How You Can Profit from the Coming Devaluation. And this goes back to what I alluded to briefly at the beginning of this show and have discussed on previous shows, especially on the last one, and that is that there were extraordinary conditions that existed then that made it very likely that gold, silver, and foreign currencies would have to explode. And the way that I expected gold to go up was through a formal devaluation. Now, we have to understand what a devaluation is. There was a time when governments had a fixed rate for gold and their currencies. In the United States, it meant that gold was pegged at $35 an ounce. Now, a long, long time ago, over 70 years ago, that would have meant that you could go to the U.S. Treasury at any time or any Federal Reserve Bank and probably many, many commercial banks and exchange $35 for gold at a fixed rate. This meant the currency was convertible. And that's the key. If a currency is convertible, then gold is exercising discipline over it. When people say a currency is backed by gold, that really means nothing. It means that the government that issues the currency has some gold in its reserves. But if it's not dealing that gold out in exchange for people bringing the currency to the government, then there really is no discipline that the gold is exercising on the currency. But at one time, that's the way it was. There still was, in the 1960s, the condition where foreign governments could exchange U.S. dollars for gold at the rate of $35 an ounce, even though Americans couldn't do that. What I expected to see was that there would be a formal devaluation, meaning that rate would go up from $35 probably to $70, maybe even to $100, in order for the government to be able to preserve that gold, given the tremendous amount of dollars that were running around overseas and could be brought by foreign governments to the U.S. Treasury to exchange for gold. In fact, there was a certain run on the U.S. Treasury. And because of the conditions that exist, that the U.S. government had issued so much money and so much of that money had gotten out overseas, I thought that a devaluation was inevitable. As it turned out, the devaluation was slight. It took the formal price of gold up to, what was it, $38 and something. But what did happen was in the free market, the price of gold exploded, so it worked out all right. But I'm going to tell you what the key was to getting that prediction that gold would go up. So don't go away, Dave. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You'll know we're back when the music starts playing again. This is Harry Brown. Welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and before we went to the break, I was talking about the devaluation in 1971. In the book, I said that I thought that the devaluation might occur any time from the coming Saturday, whenever that might be, that you were reading the book, to the end of 1971. That was my best guess. And I said the coming Saturday because devaluations almost always happened on weekends when the markets were closed. As it turned out, the devaluation did come in December of 1971, making my prediction work out all right. And over the years, many people have asked me, how is it that my timing was so good that I was actually able to predict this down to a time frame? Well, I will let you in on a little secret. The reason I was able to do so was that I was lucky. And there is more truth than facetiousness in my saying that I was lucky. I could have written that same book in 1965, and it would have made the same sense, but people would have had to sit on it for 5 or 6 years. If I'd had the chance to write it and get it published in 1965, I would have done so. The point is that the conditions were there. It was just a question of time, but that time could turn out to be several years. In my case, it just so happened that it occurred the next year, and even better, gold in the free market shot upward to $100 by the beginning of 1973, came back down a bit, and then in 1974 just started going crazy. So anyway, I hope that answers your question, Dave. So often when somebody is dining out for the rest of his life on some great prediction, you don't know, but what he was just lucky, and you also don't know about all the predictions he made that didn't pan out. You only hear about the one that did, because that's the thing that's extraordinary. The ones that didn't pan out are very commonplace.
Yes, you know, I certainly understand the ease of creating a lot of money versus the ease of finding gold, and eventually the price of money had to go down relative to gold. But it certainly seems that the price of everything went up with respect to the dollar, not just gold.
Sure.
There must have been a lot of additional money creation that was going on during that time.
Well, things were going upward, yes, very definitely, because the money supply was increasing rapidly. But gold was going up so much faster because it had so many years to make up for. Gold had been pegged at $35 an ounce back in 1933. So, in effect, it was making up for about 37 years of price controls. You price control something for a year, and it's when you release the price control, it's going to shoot upward faster than other things are going up because it has a year to make up for. But 37 years, that really is going to require an accelerated increase. And it was the same with silver and foreign currencies. And now people today talk about a coming devaluation of gold. Well, there will be no devaluation because we're no longer on a gold standard, and a devaluation only has meaning on a gold standard. The question is, will the free market price of gold rise from the $400 area where we are now? And the fact is that it will do so when inflation is noticeable. When inflation is running 5, 6, 8, 10%, then it is almost guaranteed that gold is going to rise. And it will rise fairly powerfully because gold is really a leveraged investment, figuratively speaking. And so you could see gold at 6, 8, 100, maybe even $1,000 an ounce just if we have 6 or 7% inflation. But as long as inflation remains around 2% or so, it's not going to happen because people around the world are not going to worry about their dollar holdings. But get inflation up to 5 or 6%, and a lot of people around the world who are holding dollars are going to switch them into gold because gold is the second most popular form of money in the world. The dollar is the first. Dave, thanks so much for your call. Glad to hear from you anytime. All right, we were talking about foreign banks, and I mentioned that as a way of keeping money outside the reach of your own government. And on the Radio Links page, I put the name of an Austrian bank, which caters to U.S. clients, and there are other banks that specialize in U.S. clients. They have everybody in the bank speaking very colloquial English, rather than the kind of stilted English that you might run into from people where English is a second language. And they are prepared to deal with Americans and glad to get Americans' business. And that's what the one bank I put on the Radio Links page does. It's a bank in Austria. In Austria, incidentally, bank privacy is in the constitution of the country, meaning the lawmakers can't next year just go out and suddenly pass a law saying we're repealing bank privacy. From now on, banks can provide information to anybody they know. And incidentally, bank privacy, what it means is simply this, that if anyone in the bank reveals to anyone outside the bank that you even have an account at that bank, let alone any details of it, the person who has done the revealing could go to jail. It is a felony to reveal information to outsiders about anyone's bank account within the bank. That's what's meant by bank privacy. When we come back, I'll talk about some other alternatives to keeping things out of the reach of the government. Stay tuned. And that music introduces the final segment of this show, and since this is the final segment, let me thank you very, very much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll come back again next week. And I want to thank John Harmon in Minnesota who for turning all the right dials and pushing all the right buttons so that we were on the air today. I received an email from Aaron who says, "What about gold confiscation?" Well, I do not see gold confiscation as an immediate possibility simply because it wouldn't accomplish anything for the government. Gold was confiscated in 1933 as part of the devaluation of the dollar and part of a plan by Henry Wallace in Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet to stimulate the economy. It was a stupid plan, and it didn't accomplish anything. And today, since we're not on a gold standard, it would accomplish even less. But you never know with politicians, and that's why it's a good idea to have gold out, some gold outside the reach of the government. And Aaron asks, what about the laws requiring you to declare foreign accounts? If you are just simply storing gold in a foreign bank account, you don't really have a bank account, a financial account. What you have is a storage account, and I have never heard of anybody being prosecuted for not declaring that. And Aaron also asks, this is an email that I received from Aaron, where can I get more info on the best way to set up foreign bank accounts? Well, I put a link on the Radio Links page to my book, Failsafe Investing, which might give you some help in that regard. I promise to tell you other lawful ways that you can keep wealth private. One is to buy some gold coins, keep them at home, store them yourself, or put them in a safe deposit box. And so long as you don't sell them, you don't have to report them to the tax collector. You might also want to have some cash tucked away somewhere for protection against the unforeseeable, such as civil disorder, a hurricane, whatever might break down the normal things. It is always good to have some cash, and it's always good to have some gold coins. And if you would like more privacy over your financial affairs, I think that just making the decision to look for ways of being private probably will open your mind to alternatives that you hadn't noticed before. Suddenly, when you make the decision that this is something I want to do, you get all kinds of ideas. Just think them through and don't leap at something as being a somewhat obvious way of doing something, but think about it for a few days before you act to make sure that you have noticed all the ramifications, all the consequences of it. Well, that's it for today. I hope that you will come back again next week, and that's what this music is saying. It's saying, come back, sweet papa. Come back next week, and let's talk some more about your money, your savings, the economy, and ways that you can take advantage of the opportunities that are available to make sure that what you have is safe. So do come back, sweet papa, and this is Harry Brown. I'll be here waiting for you. Goodbye.